The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. And the season isn't just starting in England, it's starting all over Europe. So let's find out what's happening. Ligue 1 starts on Friday. PSG aren't the reigning champions, will they? Against all the odds, brackets against none of the odds, be back on top this time around. Why would Inter let Lukaku go? Lots of money, I guess. Has Jose thrown anyone under the bus in Rome yet? Where are Juve at too? Have Barcelona got any money? Will Gareth Bale unleash chaos? The chaos he promised. In Germany, there's a delightfully well-organised managerial merit go round, all of which means Bayern will win the league. And of course, we are live outside the Spurs training ground to see if a man has turned up for work or not. All that plus your questions on today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Lars Sivertsen, welcome.
Hi, Max. How's it going?
I'm very good. Thank you very much. Bonjour, Philippe Auclair.
Bonjour, monsieur.
And Nicky Bandini, hello.
Good morning, Max. How are you?
I'm good. Now, Nicky, before we go anywhere, you never got to be joyous about Italy winning the Euros. You did send a joyous voice note, but it was too noisy, or it didn't work.
No, I was confused. I heard a podcast about England losing the Euro final, but I haven't heard one yet about Italy winning the Euro final. So not
the floor
sure.
The floor is yours, Nicky.
Not sure if that history got rewritten somewhere by the English audience that we've got here.
Yeah, go on then.
I mean, I don't know. It feels like it's already ancient history, isn't it? Because that's how the world moves these days. But it was an amazing moment. It was an amazing sort of experience to be there for it. There was lots that was not great about that experience inside Wembley for the final, but the Italian joy that was present at one end of Wembley was really something. And I actually know some people who were in that section of the stand as well, and I was getting sort of live updates from them as I was trying to file my copy at the end of the evening, getting all these sort of videos of them enjoying themselves. But I thought it was just a magnificent Italy team. I really hope that it's a team that will endure and that we'll see more of when we come to the World Cup, which feels like it's only 5 minutes away already. I think everything about it, from the fact that Spinazzola goes up first to collect the winner's medal, I think that sort of real sort of team spirit that you got from this group under Mancini, which is such a funny concept, I think, when you think about Mancini's earlier periods of manager, when it seemed to be all about him. It was all about him and him sort of flouncing at Inter and threatening to quit when he was in the middle of a season. And instead, he sort of brought this group together around him and Viali and Lombardo all being there as a group and saying, look, football's about your mates. Football's about doing this with your friends and getting the Italy team to buy into that. And then on top of that, individual performances from players like Chiesa, who I think showed the world a bit what he's about. Jorginho, who I, even though every time I say this, I get a lot of English fans telling me I'm wrong, I think should be up for the Ballon d'Or this season. I thought even some sort of really unlikely stories in that final, like Federico Bernardeschi, who absolutely changed that game with them. Sorry, I'm getting myself mixed up now. I meant to say Domenico Berardi, who changed that game when he came on. Or the Federico Bernardeschi, who is a really unlikely story, who scored a penalty, came on. Bernardeschi, who has gone to Juventus, went to Juventus as someone who's supposed to be one of the rising Italian stars, and who basically disappeared off the map at Juventus, barely gets a game, has completely fallen behind players like Chiesa, but then comes into the final. You see him line up to take a penalty and you think, this is the player who misses, right? This is the player whose story is doomed. But he doesn't, he converts it. So many stories within a story in that final. But a brilliant final, a brilliant Euros for Italy. And it was a bit sad that Football Weekly did completely focus on the English side of it after the final. I thought that was a shame.
I do like the Italian and you banging the desk as you were saying that, just in case anybody wondered what that sort of banging noise was happening as Nicky was getting very excited. Philippe, you had a question.
Yeah, I just wanted to know, in the honours system in Italy, I mean, there are no knights and no lords, but is Roberto Mancini, has he acquired a new status?
I think he certainly has. I think any time a football manager in this is true in any country. I know Italy's had more success in football than England has, but I think it's still not so many titles that it's a normal thing to do, right? There's a very select number of managers who won a major football tournament for Italy. So yes, I think Mancini will forever be remembered as a brilliant Italy manager, no matter what happens next. But of course, when he took the job, right from the beginning, the thing he has talked about is winning a World Cup. So for him, it's only the start of the journey.
That's interesting as well. I mean, because Italy have won more major tournaments than England. And I was thinking about this, you know, in the lead up to the final and stuff about, you know, those 11 players who won the World Cup for England are, you know, are deified because there are only 11 of them. And because there are, you know, there are more French, you know, players who've done it and more Italians, you know, do they all get to that status? Because I was sitting there going, I don't know if I want Mason Mount to be Sir Mason Mount. obviously I do, but I, you know, I found myself with this sort of weird philosophical conflict.
But
having raised his name, I don't think Bernardeschi is going to be remembered famously in Italy for a long time. But Chiellini, sure, Chiellini is going to be remembered. And I think Chiellini is a great example of one of those players who no one was not going to think of Chiellini as having had a great career. But you think he's dominated in Italy, he's dominated and dominated. But because Juventus never win in Europe, he hasn't won something internationally. And he just missed that 2006 win. I think for him to be able to sort of go and get this, I think that was a definitely something that will cement him as one of the really, really sort of long-lasting, enduring names in Italian football for sure.
Have we done enough on Italy, Nikki? Are you okay? Are you happy now?
I'm good. I think Lars wanted to come in, but I don't know if that was about it.
No, not important at all.
Well, makes a change, eh, Lars?
Yeah.
Doesn't it? We'll get to Serie A in a bit. Germany and Spain. Let's start in France, though, Philippe, because the season starts this weekend. Monaco v Nantes on Friday night, and PSG lost to Lille in the Trophée des Champions, which I presume is the charity shield.
Yes.
And you say it has got tongues wagging.
Yes. Well, because they lost. And so immediately people started to say, is it the end? I'm not exaggerating when I say that. There were polls online and there were, I mean, the notice boards were exploding with things that says, Pochettino was doomed. He doesn't know what he's doing. PSG in a downward spiral. I mean, we have to perhaps remind ourselves that this the PSG team which played the Trophée des Champions didn't have Mbappe or Neymar or Di Maria, you know, three minor players who were still recuperating from, you know, what they did in the Copa America and the Euro. But yeah, there's a strange atmosphere. But to be honest, Max, the beginning of the season is completely overshadowed by what is happening off the pitch in France. It's an absolute shambles. I mean, I'm not just talking about the financial state of most of the clubs in Ligue 1, which is catastrophic, but we are just a few days away from the first round, and we still don't know who is going to broadcast the main two games of the weekend, which is the champion Lille playing in Troyes and PSG playing in Metz. And I say Metz, which obviously you could spell a different way, because that's exactly what it is. And for people who are maybe not aware of it, what happened is that there was a collapse of MediaPro, the company which was supposed to broadcast, had signed this amazing contract with the French Professional League and had to default, basically. So panic, and the rights were put back on the market. And Amazon Prime actually got rights to 80% of the games, at a cost of about 275 million euros, so a massive depreciation. But extraordinarily enough, Canal Plus, who was a sub-licensee of beIN Sport, still had two games, but they had to pay 322 million for two games per round. So they said, no, we're not going to do that. So beIN Sport turned to them and said, well, no, you're going to pay. And it's going to a court tomorrow. The day after tomorrow, sorry, Thursday, 1 p.m., and a judge will decide who's got to pay whom. And it is also the day on which the first installment of the payments is due, right? Also, to complicate matter a little bit more, it so happens that the most influential person on the league, the professional league in France, is one Nasser Al-Khelaifi, who is also in charge of beIN Sport. But no conflict of interest.
The man who saved us from the Super League, the hero.
The hero. Yeah. So it's an absolute mess, and it's basically dominating absolutely everything else in France. despite, I mean, there are loads of other things happening. Maybe we can have a quick word about that. But like the way Bordeaux was has been sold to Gérard Lopez, the former owner of Lille, which is absolutely a flabbergasting decision.
Because why?
Well, because Gérard Lopez, and this is where you'll have to call in the lawyers, my dear Max.
There we go. Gérard
Lopez had bought Lille doing basically a leverage buyout, a bit like the Glazers did, okay? But borrowing the money at extortionate rates from a management, a private equity fund called Elliott. And strangely enough, despite the fact that Lille was making loads of money from selling players, you know, their best players every year, the club hemorrhaged money. So nobody's quite sure. This is beep, 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 beep. Nobody's quite sure what happened to that money. There are many theories.
But Philippe Auclair's Roadrunner is one of my favorite.
And the management was so bad that the guys Lopez had borrowed the money from decided to get rid of him. And he was got rid of last December. So they've got a new ownership structure at Lille. Well, a new ownership structure. And everybody thought, well, that's it for Lopez. I mean, Formula One fans will remember what he did with Lotus as well, which is also another topic that we won't touch with a barge pole. But amazingly, Mr. Lopez has been given the ownership, the green light to buy Girondins de Bordeaux, a great French club. I mean, a historic French club. So, yeah, I mean, as you can see, there's a really nice, cozy, friendly, celebratory atmosphere around what's happening in Ligue 1, and that's before we've gone to the football itself.
Yeah, can we?
It promises to be a great season.
Yeah, well, I don't. No one will see it, but it. You know, if nobody sees it, how do we know?
But Philippe, with this deal being in the state that it is, you know, there are a lot of clubs here who are not going to have any money. I mean, obviously, PSG have wealthy backers. Monaco have some backing. Lyon have some backing. Rennes is owned by Salma Hayek's in-laws, by the way, for people who don't know that.
What?
That's quite tremendous. Rennes are owned by the Pinot family, of course. So Salma Hayek's in-laws own Rennes, so they have a bit of money. But apart from that, there are a lot of clubs here who are going to have a tremendously bad time. Are all their players for sale? I think is something English clubs would be interested in knowing.
Quite a few. But there is one club buying, though, which might be the surprise, which is Marseille, because Marseille is also losing a lot of money. They've signed an awful lot of people. They've signed Chenzi Kunda, from Roma. Matteo Guendouzi and Saliba are arriving on loan from Arsenal. They also bought Conrad de la Fuente from Barcelona, whom I actually saw in a warm-up game, and he was absolutely terrific, by the way, de la Fuente. So Marseille, strangely enough, might be one of the teams that somehow, despite the fact that, again, they're heavily in debt and nobody's quite too sure about where the money's coming from, might have a decent season. They certainly have made the efforts on the transfer market for that.
What do you think about PSG and their signings looking at the Champions League?
Well, I mean, the signings are pretty impressive when you think about, you know, I mean, when the signings, I mean, three of them are free transfers, but they are not exactly small names. Right. Donnarumma, Wijnaldum, Sergio Ramos. So you can imagine that the impact is going to have on the wage bill is going to be something else. And they've also, of course, bought Achraf Hakimi from Inter for 60 million euros. So they've made a very big effort. And to be honest, they're running out of arguments when it comes to we don't have the necessary players perhaps to do what we should be doing in the Champions League. So, yes, I mean, to be honest, yes, they're running out of excuses for that.
Do we think that Mbappe will still be there?
It seems that he's going to stay, and he's going to be yet another of those big players who, just like Wenger had predicted, is going to go to the end of his contract and is going to make a massive amount of money by moving next year.
Like Donnarumma did, in fact. I'm curious about Donnarumma's situation. Obviously, he had another player at a fantastic Euros, was already having a fantastic recent times in Italy. He's someone who should be starting games, but so should Keylor Navas. So there was speculation in Italy when he first went there that he might get sent out on loan right away. I don't know if that's possible or if there's... what's the plan? What's likely to happen, do you think?
To be honest, I think the idea of him going on loan would be... when you think that he's a candidate for the Ballon d'Or because of his performances in the Euro, I can't imagine for one second. I mean, Keylor Navas was one of the best performers for PSG last season. He was one of the main reasons why they actually progressed that far in the Champions League. But he's getting on a bit. I think he's 34 now. And they really felt they needed somebody to take over. So my own feeling, and to be honest, it's a feeling more than anything else, Nicky, is that Donnarumma and him are probably going to battle it out, fight it out for a while. But that I think Donnarumma is obviously going to be the number one in the short to medium term.
Both often wear short sleeves, so neither can be trusted. Let's go to Germany, Lars. Lars Sivertsen's Bundesliga Rundfunk. As producer Sammy writes, it's sort of managerial keys in the bowl. It's sort of fascinating. Joachim Löw leaves Germany. Germany take Hansi Flick from Bayern. Mm. Bayern go to Leipzig for Nagelsmann. Leipzig go to Salzburg for Jesse Marsch.
Correct.
Dortmund take Marco Rosa from Gladbach. Gladbach take Adi Hütter from Frankfurt. Frankfurt take Oliver Glasner from Wolfsburg. And Wolfsburg appoint Marco van Bommel. So only Van Bommel is the out-of-work manager who gets one job. I have a million jobs.
Yeah.
Van Bommel is the only one who gets one. It all seems, I mean, I don't know how amicable it was. It seems very sort of just move around the table one.
Yes, we're going into the season with the seven teams who certainly the bookies see as the seven strongest and the seven you'd expect to end up in the top seven places, all having new managers, which is quite unusual. And all of the sort of chain reaction you listed, I mean, the particularly funny one is the sort of Rosa, Hütter, Glasner debacle, which is everyone sort of moving sideways. I think Glasner going from Wolfsburg, who he just got into the Champions League, to Frankfurt, who just missed out on the Champions League, is maybe a slightly odd one. But perhaps he felt he'd taken them as far as he could. And Wolfsburg are one of these sort of inverted commas, slightly fake clubs. I mean, they're an old company club and, not a lot of fans there. And maybe he just felt the potential in Frankfurt is greater. I'm not sure. But it's a very, very interesting merry-go-round going into this season, for sure. And let's also not forget Stefan Baumgart, who's taken over at Köln. So that's a new one as well.
Dortmund have lost Sancho.
Yeah.
What do you think Haaland will still be there?
Yeah, I do. Listen, you can never say never, because Dortmund are a club who do, I mean, their business model, part of it is raising money through sales. So there is a price tag, at which point they'll just have to go, yeah, fair enough. But it's going to have to be a completely mad price tag. It'll have to be if Abramovich gets up in the morning and thinks, ah, well, I will, I don't know where he's from. I will, let's not do the accent. I'm just going to, he turned into Sven there for a minute. If Abramovich just gets up in the morning and decides I'm going to spend 200 million euros on Haaland, then of course they'll have to listen. But it's going to take something completely off kilter like that for that to happen this summer. So I really don't think so. Sebastian Kehl, who's the sort of technical director type man, one of them anyway, has said he doesn't think he's going to move. So I really don't think it's happening. I don't think the plan is for him to go. I mean, you'll remember the sort of Mino Raiola, Alfie Haaland, European city break bonanza in the spring happened as it looked like they might miss out on the Champions League. If they'd missed out on the Champions League, that would have changed the equation slightly. But since they made it in the end, I think they're quite happy for him to be at Dortmund for one more year. And for Dortmund's perspective, yeah, they could raise more money by selling him now, but their thinking is if he stays, then they're almost guaranteed to make the Champions League again. They have an outside chance of a title push, and that's worth a bit of extra money, having him one more season.
What about Bayern? I flippantly said in the intro they'll win the league. Alaba's gone, Boateng's gone, Martinez is gone. They brought in Upamecano, who in the sort of, I don't watch him all the time, but sometimes I think, God, he's amazing. And then sometimes he does something you know, not very good.
Yeah.
And they brought in Omar Richards from Reading, who I was not aware of.
So, this is the question everyone's asking themselves this time of year. Can anyone beat Bayern? And the answer is probably not. But if we're looking for things that could go wrong here, yeah, you're right, David Alaba has left. Jerome Boateng has left as well. And he, you know, he's getting on a bit. But, you know, he started 29 games in the league last season, so he's not an insignificant departure for them. There are little sort of, there's a little bit of unrest in the team because of finances and stuff, because it increasingly looks like the Leroy Sané deal wasn't quite as clever as it seemed at the time. One thing is that he's not really fitted in. He's been criticized a bit for not really getting the sort of Bayern way, but also financially. I mean, they put him on huge money, and the sort of wage structures of these clubs is very important. You know, you have a system where, you know, Lewandowski, Müller and Neuer are on big money, and then there's a little gap down to the rest of them, and everyone's kind of okay with that because those three have kind of earned it. But now they've put Leroy Sané in that sort of top wage bracket, and when he's a little bit in and out of the team and isn't really producing, then you have guys like Kingsley Coman and Serge Gnabry looking at Sané thinking, he shouldn't be making a lot more than us. And when you have to renegotiate Goretzka's contract, he'll look at it and say, well, I'm certainly not going to have a lot less than him. So the sort of contractual stuff sort of buzzing in the background that could be not so great for squad harmony.
Yeah, and Goretzka, when it comes to it, I think there's a report almost from Bild saying that he's not going to sign an extension to his contract, or he's thinking very hard about doing it, and he's coming to the end of his deal in 2022.
If we're thinking about things again, we're really clutching at straws. They're the best team in the league, and they should win the league. But with Nagelsmann, a very talented young man, he undeniably is, very tactically smart, very suave, you know, gets the players, all of this. He's not been in charge of a club like Bayern before. I mean, if you look at his career so far, he's been in charge of Hoffenheim and RB Leipzig. And of course, there's pressure because you're coaching a club in the Bundesliga. But you know what? Like, if you have a bad run with Leipzig, not a lot of people care. If you have a bad run with Hoffenheim, nobody cares. No one even notices. these are sort of, again, critics will say completely artificial clubs. They're certainly clubs that don't have a huge fan base, don't have a huge media presence. There's not a bunch of ex-pros and pundits who have opinions and influence in the media. Really, nobody cares about Hoffenheim. So just the pressure of being in charge of Bayern Munich, every single decision he makes is going to be scrutinized. Every defeat is like a regional catastrophe. You know, you have incredibly strong personalities in the media and the dressing room and all these dudes who are hanging around who have opinions, very strong characters in the team. All this stuff is kind of new for Nagelsmann. So he's going to have to, you know, hit the ground running a little bit. And you have this, but again, they're the best team in the league. They should probably win the league. But there are these little sort of interesting things percolating away that could potentially destabilize them.
If I do nothing else this season, I'm going to care about Hoffenheim just to make them feel a little bit better. All right, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll do Serie A and La Liga. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. We've got a live show on August the 12th. Me, Barry Wilson and Philippe Auclair. You get to drink a bottle of wine, Philippe.
Yes.
And if you tell a story like Barry told on the last pod, I'll be very surprised because I can't imagine you just doing your ablutions on a tube train. I just can't imagine.
Oh, dear.
And not just that one, Philippe, all the way. Anyway, if you go to theguardian.com/guardianlive, you can see a picture of me and Barry's face. Click on that one. If you click on the ones next to it, Football Weekly Live on the page is very different to the rest of the offerings from The Guardian, I would point out. You can, on the 26th of August, watch a live show from a journalist called Oliver Berkman, who is telling you how to spend your 4,000 weeks on Earth. Arguably a deeper question. Look, if you could spend 1 hour, 1.5 hour of one of your 4,000 weeks watching us on your laptop, that would be great. So theguardian.com/guardianlive for that. Serie A starts in 2 weeks, starts a week later than the Premier League, La Liga and the Bundesliga. Jack says, how many times do Chelsea have to buy Lukaku before they give him a chance?
That's terrific.
What do you think is going to happen there?
If you'd asked me even a week ago, maybe even less than that, I would have said I think he's going to stay. But as of yesterday, I'm now pretty firmly convinced that he's going to go. It's a real surprise to me on a number of levels. Inter's ownership, from their point of view, they'd made a pretty clear stance that we're going to sell Hakimi, but we're going to keep the title-winning team together. So we're just letting go of one piece because we have to balance the books, because everyone knows the Chinese government has put a huge restriction on foreign spending for businesses that are Chinese, and this is a Chinese-owned business. Suning is a Chinese company that owns Inter. But the deal was that we sell Hakimi and that's it. And I actually think they did intend to stick to that. And the reason they're not going to is because this offer for Lukaku is so much. It's escalated now to 130 million euros, which would be the biggest sale that Inter have ever made. It would be, I think, the biggest ever Premier League purchase. I'm not 100% sure on that one, but it's certainly a huge amount of money that's being offered. And when you look at it, when you take a step back and look at this from a business standpoint, Inter paid 60 million for a player 2 years ago, actually 60 million with bonuses. So if all the bonuses are triggered, I think it might have gone up to 70 million, but 60, 70 million 2 years ago for a player who was not a kid, someone who was already in the middle of his career. So now you're 2 years later, you're moving towards the point where value will start to depreciate and you're being offered almost double that amount. So it is an extraordinary deal financially for Inter in terms of just purely that side of it. From a footballing standpoint, I think it's a catastrophic move for Inter. You're talking about probably the single most important player in their team last season, certainly the single most important player in the fans' affections, someone who has literally in the last year had two murals made of him right outside San Siro, who was absolutely the iconic figure in that title triumph, who was the one who seemed perhaps even out of everyone in that Inter team, not saying the others weren't, but almost the most emotionally invested in the team at that point. He was the one out riding his car around town, like I said at the time, you know, waving out the windows and enjoying it with fans. He is so much the symbol, other than Antonio Conte, of the team that just won the league. And him leaving right away is astonishing that it's going to happen. I think, as I said, I do think it's going to happen now. I think I'm slightly surprised that he's gone for it, because I think, again, if you'd asked me a week ago, the reason I would have said it won't happen is even less to do with Inter than it is to do with Lukaku. I think Lukaku really, really has enjoyed his time in Milan, has enjoyed being the man, which I think has not been the case for him. And a lot of his stops in England, there's been this sort of, I don't know, so much else going on when he was at United, when he was at Chelsea, except maybe at Everton, where he did get to be the guy and you know, bullied and trampled, but didn't win titles. I'm surprised a little bit that he's willing to let go of it. But then again, the figures being talked about are huge. He's being talked about a huge increase in the amount he's going to earn. And it seems like in the end on this one, for all parties concerned, money is going to talk.
And just, I mean, he's so important to them that it almost completely changes their season and what they do. Yeah. I can't think of it's not unlike Kane. I just can't think of a replacement. In many ways, even more, I can't think of Lukaku replacement.
Funnily enough, the same player is the one who I think would probably be the best replacement for both teams if those players are sold, which is Dusan Vlahovic from Fiorentina, who is absolutely not going to step in to Inter tomorrow or Tottenham tomorrow and play at the level that Kane and Lukaku are capable of, because he's 21 years old. But at least that is a player who is genuinely really exciting and who you can think this is a step that we can make justifiably for the future. What I think is going to be a real problem, and you could certainly apply this to Tottenham as well, if you sell Lukaku now for 130 million, 2.5 weeks away from the start of the season, and then you go and, you know, walk up to Club B and say, right, we need to sign your striker now, you're not going to get a good deal, because that club has to replace its striker so close to the start of the season, and also knows you've got 130 million euros burning a hole in your pocket. So I think it's really hard to see how this comes together well for Inter in the short term. I think it completely transforms my idea of what's possible in this title race. If I'm being honest, I think this is taking this from being an interesting season where I think Inter were going to have a tough time defending the title that would have been absolutely in it, to me thinking, unless something surprising happens in the transfer market, I think Juventus are probably going to have a comfortable ride to the title this season, because I don't think that Inter, without Hakimi, without Lukaku, are anything like the team they were before.
And what about Juve? We had a question from Juve, who I think is a Juve fan, saying, are Juve really as broke as everyone makes out? I don't know if they are or not.
No one in Italy has money to spend. Juventus have certainly lost a heap of money on their recent accounts because they spent aggressively. Obviously, the Ronaldo deal was by far and away the most obvious one, but they've also brought in high-wage players on free transfers, including Aaron Ramsey, Adrian Rabiot, who perhaps haven't lived up to what they hoped. And like everybody else in Italian football, and indeed most of European football, they've been dealing with empty football stadiums. So I don't know what as broke as everybody makes out means. I do think they're in a better financial position than some of their rivals, because in the end, what Fiat or Exor, the ownership group, tend to do when they are struggling a bit is do another cash raise and put some more money into the club. So they're not up against the wall in that sense, but they are certainly not going to spend lavishly this summer. And again, as I've sort of laid out, probably they don't need to, because their rivals, for the most part, aren't looking like they're really ready to fight at that level again.
Looks like they're selling Demirel to Atalanta, who look like they're selling Romero to Spurs. Who wins in that situation?
I really like Christian Romero. I think he was such an important part of that Atalanta team this season. I do think it's worth saying that every player is a product of their environment and thrives in particular environments. Romero was brilliant for an Atalanta team that, as we talk about ad nauseam, I'm sure, plays a very attacking brand of football, plays a football that's all based on one-on-one battles, and in which Romero's aggression, because he's a very aggressive defender, really was an asset, because you're trying to win the ball back and launch the counter-attack right away. I think he had the most interceptions per game of any player in Serie A, because he plays that sort of aggressive, stepping out, looking for those opportunities to break up play. On the other hand, I think he also had the most fouls per game in all of Serie A. So he's someone who is putting themselves about there and who can get themselves in trouble. I think he got 10 yellow cards this season. So he is someone who plays on that line quite a lot. But he's 23 years old. He's fast. He's strong. He's really, really impressive. The only other thing I would say on that is there is a bit of a, I think everyone should have a bit of a buyer beware with Atalanta, because there are so many players now who've looked brilliant at Atalanta under Gasperini and go somewhere else and they don't look so brilliant anymore, because he's a wonderful manager and he knows how to get the best out of what he has. But on paper, I think that's a good signing for Tottenham. I like Romero a lot. Demiral is someone who's had ups and downs at Juventus. He's obviously cheaper, and that's, you know, what Atalanta are always doing. They're selling someone, making a profit, bringing in someone to replace them. I'm sure he'll do fine, because same thing again, Gasperini always finds a way to get the most out of what he has.
How do you think Roma will do under Mourinho?
Do you know, I was thinking just this morning about the Lukaku situation, thinking if ever there was an opportunity now for Mourinho, he's not going to win the league. It's not realistic. That Roma team is nowhere near the talent depth of Juventus. But the fact that no one else behind Juventus has taken a big step forward, and a team like Inter are taking a step backward, really, makes me think it's not as impossible as I maybe once thought for that team to be pushing on into the top four and getting somewhere. It's certainly a big loss. Spinazzola is obviously a big loss. Everyone saw how good he was at the Euros. There's a pretty big question still about this team's situation up front, because Edin Dzeko is only getting older. And frankly, the club would like to move him on and bring someone else in, but his wages are a sticking point. So probably they will be relying on Dzeko again. There's some really good players in that team, some good young Italian players. Obviously, Spinazzola isn't that young anymore, but is not old either. And then you've got Pellegrini, you've got Cristante in the midfield, who provide a really sort of solid platform. But I have questions not only about the attack, but also about the way the team has been built at the back. Someone like Chris Smalling, who was brought in specifically to play in Paulo Fonseca's high line. Paulo Fonseca plays this really high line, pressing up the pitch, and he was good at that because he's fast. Smalling, as we know, didn't get on the best of Mourinho at United, a bit like Mkhitaryan, by the way, although they say they cleared the air. And how is that going to work out? Is Mourinho going to work with what he has, or are we going to see perhaps a familiar story with Mourinho and him imposing himself and finding certain players don't fit what he wants and complaining about those? I think it's interesting that he opened his opening press conference at Roma. He said he's expecting a few gifts from the club, and so far I don't think those have really arrived. They've brought in Rui Patricio to play in goal, and they've brought Shomurodov up front, who had a so-so time at Genoa, even though I've seen him described by someone online as the Uzbek Messi, which I think is a bit optimistic. And he's a young player, so I'm not trying to do him down either. He might flourish and be brilliant.
Nicky, who do you think will be the sort of Mourinho sacrificial lamb, like the player who he'll sort of ostracize for absolutely no reason just to make an example of him?
I don't know if I have a definite one in mind. And the obvious choice is Mkhitaryan, because it's happened before. Mm. On the other hand, this team kind of needs Mkhitaryan, because again, there's not really a clear sort of dominant number nine right now, and unless Dzeko can recapture all glories yet again. But you need goals from elsewhere on the pitch, and Mkhitaryan is someone who does provide those.
William says, are Barcelona allowed to register any players yet? Is Sergio Aguero sitting twiddling his thumbs somewhere? Lars, let's look at La Liga. What's happened with that? Are they allowed to play?
No is the short answer to that. Without getting too far into the weeds, the way the sort of financial controls work in Spain, I mean, we're used to having FFP where sort of UEFA or Premier League look over your books after the fact and see, oh, did you use enough? Did you have the money? No, pointy finger. Did you have those monies that you used? Whereas in La Liga, as in France, they sort of, you have to hand in financial data. And then the league will sort of decide if you're running it sustainably. And the league in Italy, no, sorry, the league in Spain will set a wage cap for you based on the sort of projected finances for the year. Now, Barcelona's projected finances for the year are not very good. Now, we don't know for sure what the number is going to be yet, what their wage cap is going to be, but we know it's going to be very low. It's been speculated in the media that it could be as low as 200 or even all the way down to like 160, 170 million euros. That is a lot less than they're spending now. And it's sort of on par with mid-table clubs in England. Like 200 million euros, I guess, is roughly what Everton are spending. I mean, 160 million euros, I mean, allowing for a bit of currency fluctuations, we're not a million miles away from what Crystal Palace are spending on wages then. I mean, it might not be that low in the end, but I mean, this is what we're talking about. They're going to have to reduce their wages considerably. They're trying to make people go away. You have like Pjanic, Umtiti, guys like this, they would like them to go away. It would be great if they could find someone to buy Griezmann, for instance, but that's probably not happening. Dembele, they would probably be hoped to sell, but he's injured now. They have a huge problem just trying to get people out of there.
The debt at the moment is over 1.2 billion euros, of which I think something like half is due to be repaid by the end of the year, which means they will have to reconsolidate the debt, find money somewhere else. They basically will have to find about 200 million euros worth of savings in terms of expenses, which of course makes it completely crazy, because just Lionel Messi's contract, you know, is going to eat most of the money they're supposed to be able to spend just for one player, whom they can't let go, obviously. So the situation is crazy. And obviously the word is always, where's Barcelona? So La Liga cannot do without Barcelona. They'll find a way somehow. The fact is that the Spanish FFP rules have got teeth. They will have to, they are usually implemented quite strictly. And you could imagine the reaction of other La Liga clubs if Barcelona was somehow allowed to find a backdoor and to be able to register all these players, you know, Aguero, Emerson, Depay, Eric Garcia is another one. And to do that and to say, oh yeah, that's cool, we need a strong Barcelona. Well, if you're, I don't know, Sevilla or Villarreal, I'm not sure that you would look at things quite that way. And it is absolutely, I mean, abysmal. To be honest, it's now coming home to roost, because everybody who's been watching what was happening at Barcelona for a while knows the situation was nicely bubbling up to this massive nuclear explosion, which is now being threatened on the horizon. So it's very, very, very very dangerous and very worrying, I must say, for Barca.
Not a lot has happened at Real Madrid, Lars. Is one David Alaba worth Varane and a Ramos?
Well, maybe not, but I mean, they have other defenders. I think what's happening to an extent this summer with that is that there is a sort of generational shift at Real Madrid that had to happen, and that Zinedine Zidane was very reluctant to make. He kept going back to the same old crew, but they have some younger players. You know, my boy Martin Odegaard, of course, is there. Hopefully, he will play some football, and they've got some younger players, and we're kind of hoping they will play more this season and make more of an impact because they have to. You can't, like, Luka Modric is 75 or something. Like, you can't have the same guys doing it all the time. And hopefully for them, this is the season where the squad sort of, and the younger members of the squad, take the step up. Having said that, I mean, Gareth Bale and Eden Hazard are still hanging around. One of them, definitely, I'm sure they'd wish would go somewhere else, but it doesn't look like he will. Eden Hazard, I'm sure they're still hoping there could be something there. The poor guy keeps getting injured. I mean, I'm sure there is a player there, but they have these two players they've spent a lot of money on, and they're costing them. I mean, between them, they're paying them about $1 million a week, I think. Ideally, you would want to get something out of them, but we'll see. We'll see how it goes this season. I mean, I think...
Just saying, you're just waiting for the Gareth Bale chaos. I mean, it does seem...
Yeah, we had a tweet about that, didn't we? Currently. I mean, he said there was going to be chaos when he announced what he was going to do, and there has been a distinct lack of chaos.
You can still see Real Madrid in the Champions League semi-final with Casemiro, Cruz and Modric in a three, can't you? Going, yes. Wow, actually, they played all right in the quarters. So
yeah, anyway, never ends. I mean, to a semi-serious answer, they brought in David Alaba and they have Eder Militao, who they spent quite a lot of money on, who I think they're hoping will be the next big centre-half. Nacho Fernandez has looked pretty capable when he's played as well, so they have options at centre-half. I'm sure that'll be fine. But I think the more sort of big picture story of the season is... Like, will maybe Marco Asensio find his way back again? Will Fede Valverde continue his very positive, development? What do we get from Vinicius Jr.? You have these guys who are under 25 who were meant to be the next big Real Madrid players, none of whom have really, truly stepped up. Maybe you could say Valverde has, but we're hoping for more from them.
We'll do more Spain, of course, with Sid at some point in the next couple of weeks before the season starts. That'll do for part two. Part three, we'll discuss whether you should turn up to work or not. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So several papers reporting that Jack Grealish is due in Manchester today to sign for Manchester City. £100 million British record transfer deal for that one. Harry Kane didn't turn up for training on Monday. And then obviously the world's media had, we don't have anyone live standing outside a training ground to see if he's turning up for work. Didn't turn up for work on Tuesday. Apparently might turn up later this week. Before we talk about, we did a bit on Monday about Grealish and Kane playing for City. I'm more interested in what you think about Harry Kane not turning up for work, Philippe. And does this tarnish his reputation forever? Is it the end of the world? Had this been, had this been another footballer who isn't the England captain, would we all have, unfollowed him and blocked him for such a terrible move?
I genuinely struggle to have a binary position when it comes to Harry Kane. The way it's being reported on is quite strange. It's one thing or the other. There's absolutely no room for the in-between. And I think his situation is very much in-between. If indeed there is, as we have reason to believe, that there was a gentleman's agreement which had been passed between Levy and Kane, which basically was, we'll give you an exit, a ticket, if we don't achieve this in the season, and they're not true to their word, I can imagine the player being absolutely furious. So I do have some sympathy, I must say, for Harry Kane. This whole thing about the player going on strike or whatever, yes, of course, it will damage a bit his reputation. I've got a few Spurs friends who've made a parallel between him and Jimmy Greaves, who followed Tottenham when they were relegated, and so forth. But times
could
have changed.
Could say it's a different time.
Well, exactly. Times have changed just rather a bit since then. And I do have some sympathy for Kane, I must say. And the reputational damage, yes, and it probably has already been done. And the huge goodwill that a number of Tottenham supporters had towards him, and to the point that they thought, yeah, if we can sell him for a big amount of money, that's cool. He's done everything he could for us. He's been, you know, our main man for so many years now. But I'm in between, and I don't know. I think that, to be honest, in this particular case, that's the only place to be on the fence and look at how it's going to pan out. It looks as if he's going to report for training later in the week. There were also the other thing, Max, is that I'm extremely wary of what is put in the news when players are put in this position, because both the players and their representatives and the clubs are feeding stories to the media. We're only too happy to print them. So we don't know exactly the true story behind that. So am I allowed to sit on the fence on this
one? Sure. Yeah, look, as a vague Spurs fan, it's not as if Harry Kane, and Paul Hawksby was saying this, who is a Tottenham fan I was working with yesterday on the radio, saying it's not as if he gave Tottenham 2 years.
No.
You know, he's given a lot of time to this club. You know, he's given them time to be good.
Well, for free.
He's outgrown them.
I think he's been well paid for that time, if I'm not mistaken.
No, I know he has.
But I'm with Philippe overall. I'm on the fence about it, and I'm certain his reputation would be damaged to Tottenham fans. I actually don't think the fans of any other club will really think about it, because that's how that goes. The club that it feels aggrieved that the rest don't. But I do really object to this idea, in principle, that because a footballer gets advised by their agent to sign a contract that ties them somewhere, that we're not allowed to sort of think that they're allowed to have any sort of human feelings about what they want to do with the rest of their life. If we take a job and we hate it, we leave. That's what normal people do in their lives. And yes, there are contracts, and yes, that is a commitment. But who is realistically looking around football and going, oh yes, every contract, that's something that gets honoured to the letter to the full extent? It's ridiculous. It's just not a realistic position. Like, and if Harry Kane is truly unhappy in his position and feels that Daniel Levy has told him one thing and is doing another, what other option does he have if he really doesn't want to spend the next 3 years there? And the being paid thing, Lars, I mean, come on. Yeah, that's just football. Everyone gets paid loads. Like, that's neither here nor there as far as I'm concerned.
And the other thing as well is that looking at it from Harry Kane's point of view, he has the possibility of joining a club with which he's going to win titles. And so I certainly don't think that the money is the main motivation behind what he's going to do or what he would like to do, so we're told. And he's not getting any younger either. I mean, he's not washed out and so forth, whatever. But he has got an opportunity that might present itself again in the future. So, yeah, I'm actually starting to slip off the fence here.
can we get a reaction from the cold-hearted contracts well, are rare, I mean, for a reason, Lars Sivertsen?
No one forced him to sign a 6-year deal. I mean, that was his decision. And if 3 years into that deal, he decides he'd rather be somewhere else, well, that's tough. I mean, this cuts both ways.
It's not slave labor.
If he had gone into, because of all his ankle injuries, gone into like a catastrophic decline, Tottenham would have still had to pay him the salary they signed up for 3 years ago, because that's how contracts work, right? Arsenal were stuck with Mesut Ozil. Real Madrid are stuck with Gareth Bale. That's the sort of weirdness of football contracts. You're sort of tied to your employer in a way you're not in most other works of life, but you are also guaranteed an income, even if your performances suffer. I mean, that's just kind of how football contracts go. Again, he's been incredibly...
There's a difference here. If indeed there was a gentleman's agreement, which are actually things which do exist in football, it shines a completely different light on the situation. If there were no such agreement of that kind, if you had said, yeah, okay, I'm not going to leave the club. I'm going to stay an extra year. At the end of this year, we'll talk again. If it hasn't quite worked out, then I'm able to leave. If that's the agreement and the talk that they had a year ago, the player, I think, is in a position where morally, I mean, I'm with him. I think, you know, okay, a contract is one thing, piece of paper. A personal commitment is another one.
I really want to come in on the principle here, which I think is really important, because it's easy to look at Harry Kane and say exactly what's been said, which is Harry Kane's made a load of money. Don't feel sorry for him. But take this principle and apply it with the same, it's a football contract and you're stuck, to someone who gets advised by their agent horribly to sign a contract. Say, you know, some kid who hasn't got a heap of money gets advised to sign a 6-year contract at a club where they then get stuck, where they then get dumped in the reserves, don't get the opportunity they were supposed to get, where they could go somewhere else. Do you really think that that's like a good principle for like how humans should be like treated? Because you sign a contract once because someone advises you. And if you don't like that principle, you can't just say, oh, because he's rich, it doesn't apply in the same way. Like that's what really bugs me about this. Like, I think we sort of lose all of our humanity with people because they're rich and say, oh, we don't have to care about like what they actually want to do with their lives.
Okay. That is an interesting perspective. I think for, in this case, you have a player who has signed a 6-year deal with his boyhood club. He's the best paid player in their history by a million miles. And they've not considered offering this kind of money to anyone ever. And halfway through that contract, he's decided he wants to be somewhere else and he's trying to whinge his way out of the club. I don't have a lot of respect for that. You have to bear in mind, this isn't new. Like, he started before the season had even ended. They had one more game left. He went about on a golf course with Gary Neville and talked about how it was going to be his decision where he played next season, even though he's got 3 years left in his contract. It's not how it works at all. I think he's behaved very arrogantly in this whole thing. I think he seems to have been very badly advised. I'm not sure what he has to gain by antagonizing Tottenham in this situation, because at the end of the day, it's Tottenham who'll decide if he gets to go or not. Whatever gentleman's agreement there was, that's another issue where we don't really know. And we just kind of have to go by reports which are put out in the media by people who very clearly have a certain agenda here. We do know he has an actual contract, which I do think should matter a little bit here. And if Tottenham are offered a fee that they're happy with, then they can sell him. If they're not, they don't have to sell him. That's kind of how it goes.
But that, I mean, that is an interesting thing in football contracts that I don't think exists for normal people, is it? That you know, we're all doing this podcast, but if suddenly, you know, some other podcast comes and offers, doesn't pay The Guardian, let's say, I'm going to pay The Guardian £8 to get Max, and The Guardian say yes, I don't have to go. You know, like I can say, well, no, that doesn't work for me, you know, whereas that doesn't really happen in football. You know, if you get called into a room and you're playing for Rotherham, they say, we've sold you to Stevenage, and you go, yeah, but I live in Rotherham, and then you go, well, sorry.
Okay. You can just refuse to go. A lot of players do that all the time. Look at Barcelona's wage bill.
Okay, good point. I take it back.
Well,
you can and you can't, though. I mean, like,
you say that last, but give me examples of it. When a player of that stature, especially, can you quote name one who decided to stay, saying, no, I'm going to see the rest of my contract, even though I've got an offer to go to another club? I can't think of a single one.
I'm sure there are quite a lot of players who have like Gareth Bale, for instance, I'm sure will have had many opportunities to leave Real Madrid, albeit at a significant wage cut, and he'll have gone, nope, quite happy being here. Mesut Ozil, I'm sure, had quite a few chances to leave Arsenal, albeit for a slightly lesser contract. He said, nope, I'm sticking with what I have here. Like, this is pretty common.
I would disagree. I would disagree because I want to see the offers that were made for Gareth Bale to Real Madrid, and I would like to see the offers that were made to Arsenal for Mesut Ozil. And to be honest, there were not many.
I'm enjoying this. It sort of feels a bit, it's been an interesting, I was going to say, it's not quite spiky. It hasn't got to that level of chat, but I think I've fallen off the fence the way that Philippe has. Philippe sort of dived head first off the fence, didn't he? I think. But we'll see what happens, won't we?
I've only gone harder the other way, Max, to be honest. And I really, if I hear anyone ever refer to Harry Kane as this very loyal model professional man, I might vomit. I mean, if it's in his self-interest to be very loyal and very professional, then he will be. And if it's not, then he's not anymore. And loyalty is not the word for that.
Unfortunately, it's not how fans want to think about footballers, but that is the vast majority of footballers in their relationship with clubs. Lukaku, by the way, showed up a day early for training. So the opposite of Harry Kane, right? He showed up a day early. But when the offer became one that he wanted to take, he's going to take it. And that's this idea that footballers love their clubs like fans do is not real. I mean, that's kind of a separate conversation.
I completely agree with that, Nikki, but then we need to stop saying it.
Yeah, but I think what is true, the part of the reason that you know, Harry Kane has been treated in a different way to other footballers is because, you know, there is a player that always stays on his feet that...
What? That always squares this.
Exactly. Anyway.
That will never play even if he's half injured.
Anyway, we basically run out of time. VAR is changing slightly. We'll chat about that on the next pod. We don't have time for a Nordic minute, Lars. I hope you'll forgive us. Philippe, can you go two-footed in on FIFA next time? Is that okay?
Yeah.
Oh, look at you. You're so sad.
Yeah, I'm a bit sad because, I mean, we can talk about it Garten live. Obviously.
Oh, yeah, you get sued less there. But then when it's available for people the following week, suddenly they're like, I bought this ticket, but it's not available now. And it's like, yeah, well, somebody said something and they've had to do some drastic edit. Normally it's because I've played a whole Carly Rae Jepsen song, but this time it's because FIFA's lawyers are furious. But yeah, anyway, look, that'll do for today's podcast. Nikki, thanks for your time.
Thanks.
Thanks, Lars.
No, anytime, Max.
Thanks, Billy.
Thank you.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.